Everybody refreshed? Quick cup of tea? Well, my idea in these weekends, or these days really, is to you do something on the, you know, to go through the text a little bit. Well, that's slow at the moment. But there are so many kind of structures you need to be familiar with in order to kind of get an easy understanding of just the basics, never mind the complications. So, you know, there's those three vehicles and four superiors and all those sort of things, you know, so got to keep plugging away at those bit. So that's kind of the schemes or the structures that are kind of assumed, or, you know, kind of what the ornament of clear realizations is sort of, you know, kind of based on. That's what it's, the hidden meaning that Asangas, Maitreya is supposed to be bringing out are these, you know, the levels, the stages through which you go whilst you're meditating on your kind of key points of the Four Noble Truths or the emptiness of true existence and what have you. Then, you know, the stages through which you're passing as you're kind of progressing. So that's kind of the sort of structure, as I'm calling it. And then we want to try and explore a bit of the view. What is the essential point that the perfection of wisdom is making with all this denials of the existence of everything, or the denials of the existence of production, the bodhisattvas, of everything. So that's sort of the ultimate side of things. And then, of course, the other supreme joy of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras is the bodhicitta. So that's kind of something that comes along with the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, doesn't it? That sort of comes along with, you know, Nagarjuna's sort of rediscovery or kind of reintroduction of the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. This idea that we can, generate compassion for all beings. It's possible, you know, we can generate concern for all beings, no matter what they're doing to us. So that's this idea of bodhicitta. So I think we should do some little meditation on that to finish off with. I hope that's agreeable to you. I know you leave busy lives, so that a chance to do that, sit together in a sort of, you know, place, conducive place like this, is very... Mark on that tomorrow. Eight chapters, eight clear realizations. And when you add up all the topics of those chapters, they come to 70. The 70 topics. So the very first of those 70 topics is bodhicitta. So there is an opportunity when we get onto that point tomorrow, you know, to study it in the way, you know, a few of the points of the way you formally study it in the as part of the sort of ornament for clear realization study. But the actual stages of training, you know, where you go through the points to actually generate bodhicitta, those are kind of very well known, aren't they? They're not just confined to the ornament for clear realizations. Oh, no. They're all Lamrim is very much, you know, sort of coming back to that, aren't they? And the Lojong teachings, of course, are very much centered on that. So bodhicitta is such an important topic. We've all heard about it, we've all meditated on it. So the actual stages of those meditations are not something that's sort of unusually found in the ornament for clear realizations. So we know there are the sevenfold cause and effect method, which we just looked at last week, and then there's the equalizing, exchanging self and others method. So those are the two methods. So there's nothing good of Sort of new to introduce there. But my teacher at the School of Dialectics wrote some points about this. So some of those seem sort of maybe of interest to us, I don't know. So one of the things he's saying is that if you're doing a real practice, a really good practice of bodhicitta, so which method is best for you? So he seems to think that the seven cause and effect method is the simpler method. So those people who aren't so kind of, you know, sort of strongly kind of versed in the philosophy, like the sort of people who've been through the philosophy program, so maybe the sevenfold cause and effect method is best for them. So that's one we tried to do last week. So I think we all know those six causes and one effect. And we've all tried them, and we'll try those again today. But then the other way of equalizing self and others, he says that's maybe more fulfilling for people who, they've got, he says, some sort of self-reliance in terms of their discernment of the Chittamatra or Madhyamaka philosophical views. So he seems to think equalizing self and exchanging self and others is more suitable for people who've got the bit more understanding of the philosophy. But in the end, I think he says you have to meditate on them both. Yeah, you ought to unify them. So in the end, somebody should be looking to be able to practice both of them to, you know, get a real sort of forceful sense of bodhicitta. So the first one, of course, is equanimity, because that's what it's not part of the six causes, and it's not the effect. The effect is bodhicitta, of course. So why isn't equanimity one of the six causes? They all say you should always start off with equanimity, but it's not one of the six causes. It's something that's sort of precedes the six causes. Any idea why that should be the case? Yeah, it's highly recommended we start off with equanimity, but why isn't it part of the six causes? Why isn't it the seventh cause then? Why isn't it the first of this of seven causes instead of six causes? It isn't part of the six causes. It's a foundational level. Pardon? Well, its indirect effect is bodhicitta, if you then follow it up with the others. The others are only indirect effects of bodhicitta. If you just meditate on all sentient beings as been my mother, that doesn't, that doesn't sort of necessarily result in bodhicitta just by doing that meditation. So it's the equanimity, so no attachment, no anger. It's equality, like Radek is sort of thinking, yeah. So whoever they are, you've overcome any sense of attachment or anger towards them. Well, just as renunciation is in common with the individual virtual practitioners. So you wouldn't say renunciation is one of the six causes either, but obviously you've got to have it. It's no good meditating on, you know, wishing to get rid of others' suffering if you haven't wished to get rid of your own suffering properly. Everybody wishes to get rid of gross suffering, but we are in a suffering of samsara, a complete understanding of what suffering is, determined to, arise away from that, emerge from that. So you have to have renunciation in that sort of a full sense, strong sense, before you can go on to meditation on bodhicitta. But you see, equanimity is like that, and it's in common with the people of the individual vehicle. So therefore, they say it's not included in. I presume that's why it's not included in one of the six causes. It's something which is, you know, in whichever vehicle you're in, you've got to have that. All beings have been our mother. A ground for? Yeah, but that's when you're starting to have everybody appearing attractive to you, not everybody appearing in a pleasant light. Equanimity is like you're neither cross or angry or irritated with them, neither do they make you get attached or, you know, unrealistically wishing to have the pleasure of their company or whatever. You know, it's like you're just in balance, yeah, neutral. So wanting everybody to be, seeing everybody as your mother is then step beyond that. Yeah. Yeah, it's a practice common for all, you know, for the middle scope being and the great scope being. So it's not a distinctive Mahayana practice. The middle scope being is not interested in so much in complete perfect enlightenment, but it's just sort of a individual liberation. They also have to practice. So you can't say it's an uncommon meditation for the Mahayana. I think that's the reason. But then you can say, well, as the teacher says, well, what about thinking of all sentient beings as your mother? Don't you think that these here are practitioners or solitary realizer practitioners? Don't you think they also can have a sense of all sentient beings have been one's mother, because they have a full sense of, you know, cycling in samsara. They're not just people who are going to listen to Dalai Lama's teaching, and he teaches them about compassion in this life, you know, and the good reasons why compassion is necessary in our society. And, you know, the way he talks, Dalai Lama talks when he comes to London, he gives a very general talk with hardly mentioning past and future lives. When he's talking about compassion, talks very beautifully, got some great ideas. But he's avoiding the complications of past and future lives for people who think, well, you know, not ready for that. But the hearers and the solitary realizers are not like that, are they? They're not that kind of audience. They're ready for, you know, they're aware of, you know, this the whole, you know, vast sort of vision of samsara, aren't they? You know, so that we're perpetuating our suffering again and again from life to life through, you know, our deluded actions. We're buffeted by the ways of suffering, birth, aging, sickness, death, repeating themselves. So why can't they think of all sentient beings as having been their mother? Because they've had so many lives. Yeah, but if you're really cautious, you know, if somebody's debating against you, maybe they can say, look, even this point or this notion, this understanding that all sentient beings have been my mother, this awareness, this mere awareness, all sentient beings have acted as my mother, you can say, well, that's not a unique feature of the Mahayana either then, because they can think that. Yes, I think my teacher was trying to make that point. That a mere awareness that all beings have acted as one's mother is something which hearer and solitary realizer practitioners also have. And I said, why not? They've been born again and again in samsara, so it's fair enough that they should be able to think, yeah, well, every time, you know, I've been born as a human or as a certain type of animal and so forth, again and again, I have had a mother. So, you know, given samsara's limitless, you know, sort of again and again, you know, continually from beginningless time in a continuous series of birth, So then they can think that. But, so it says, then in that sense, then, it cannot be considered as a unique feature of the Mahayana. However, having adopted this point as a specific object for scrutiny and performing prolonged meditation upon it, such that one reaches a stage at which one develops a non-exerted experience, that means like effortless experience, in which one brings about a fundamental change in one's way of thinking, an automatic mental response, an ascertainment that whoever one encounters, whether friend, enemy, or stranger, they have acted as my mother on countless occasions. One would then have fully developed the mother recognition which is peculiar to the Mahayana. So have any of us managed to do that then? So you adopt it as a specific point for scrutiny and perform prolonged meditation upon it. And then you reach a stage, you reach an effortless experience, yeah? Non-exerted, it means like spontaneous experience, through the power of meditation, in which one brings about a fundamental change in one's way of thinking, an automatic mental response, an ascertainment that whoever one encounters, whether friend, enemy, or stranger, they have acted as my mother on countless occasions. Yeah, but I mean, how many have actually done it? So you've got to really like make it a kind of an automatic part of your character or whatever it is, your personality at least. So you just go on.
I mean, when I try meditating sometimes, though, you get thoughts like, well, you know, the ball's a good enemy, that's another one. But also, that comes in as part of delusions, so you can kind of dismiss that, make it that way. But then, you know,
well, I'm glad your mother isn't here to hear you say that, Jason. All the trouble she went to. Oh, just an automatic biological response. Yes, I know what you mean. You know, you've got to consider these things from all angles. So I have to answer that one. Yeah, and our teacher, he used to bring up the idea, well, your mother is only gave birth to you, only conceived you and everything, just out of attachment, yeah? So she's only like, the only you occurred in the world. You only got born because of, you know, some attachment, you see. So it's not that you have some sort of great gratitude to her. You were just born out of her sort of attachment, that delusion. So, why do I need to be so aware of my mother's kind of great kindness for me when I was born in those circumstances? So a bit like yours, only your objection, only more and more sort of Tibetan style, using afflictions rather than instincts or something. You know. Yes, but. Then you can say, well, the Tibetan answer is, or one answer is that my teacher gives is that, well, you only got into that womb, you know, you only got it conceived by that mother or those parents through your attachment, you know. It's only your attachment in the bardo state that gets you, drawn into that birth situation, that conception. So why should your mother care for you? Because you only turned up because of your attachment to getting born. So why should she care for you when you turn up, you know? What's her responsibility? Yes. Yeah. Pretty shameless, Jason. Pretty shameless.
Was it just instinctive?
No.
Yes, that's a good point. Thank you. Yeah. You know, that then when people do have unstable personalities and, you know, have a hard time in life, you know, it, as Dalai Lama says, that really does trace back often to the lack of love they had when they were children. You know, so that sort of insecurity comes from that. You know, and more than just insecurity. Insecurity is like a very mild level of it, I guess. And I guess that must be true. You know, that without that love of a child, you know, that what do you call it? Unqualified love or something. Yeah. Unconditional love of your mother or your parents or somebody, you know, grandparents maybe, whoever it was, you know, then that really like seems to be so basic in our, you know, turning out halfway all right, you know. So yeah, that society's built on that kind of love, isn't it? So if you start criticizing that, then it's like you're outside the, you know, you're just alienating yourself from being human, really. But even animals show that kind of, that attachment is there, but it's mixed with love, isn't it? It's not like attachment just pure, it's like they very much want their children to turn out right, just for the children's own sake. It's not just for their own, you know, pleasure in changing your nappies, but they really want you to become a good kid, you know, and grow up right. Yeah, that's dangerous territory there, Jason. You know, when maybe there is attachment mixed in, but, you know, when it comes to the way a mother looks after a child properly, then tons of love and affection are going into it. And you see, it's always just an instinct, but it's, it's kind of, there is an instinct thing involved. You know, you hook onto that child as my child, so you get very involved in looking after that child much more than you're interested in other children, but that's your kind of, that's your role in that kid's life. So it doesn't mean that what you're feeding that kid is love, even though you're not giving to everybody. What that kid is getting is you know, that's a love, even if it's got some basis in the instinct. Yes, when you get onto, you know, the equalizing self and other type of meditations, then everybody's been kind to you. You know, even the person who's stitching your shirt, you know, in some factory that you never even see, and whether they're getting paid well or not for it, you know, and whether they're interested in doing a good job or not, you know, the fact that the shirt serves your purpose, then they're not meant to be kind to you, but you can still think of it as kindness. You can still think of it as not necessarily their love wishing for your happiness, but you still can have a great sense of gratitude. So the person who in this life now is turning out looking sort of very grim and threatening and dangerous or unpleasant for you, you know, in so many past lives they've been exactly the opposite. So why forget that, you know? But here we're concentrating specifically on our mother, and, you know, that's the hard thing. You sort of just, can you walk down Oxford Street and automatically everybody is coming towards you, whoever they are, what kind of facial expression or race or, you know, age or, you know, funny features or, you know, straight features. They've all been my mother. You know, can you just walk around with that feeling? It's really an achievement if you can, and that's really like that Mahayana attitude. That you're, you know, the primarily you're thinking of them in that light, you know. You're not thinking, oh, they're well-dressed or, you know, they look very kind of, you know, dodgy type of character or, you know, why are they doing this, that, or the other? You know, the way we normally look at people. But the primary sort of appearance they have to us is as having been our mother. Or, you know, if you're not specifically thinking that, if you've done the meditation long enough, strongly enough, like you're supposed to, they appear with the pleasantness of a mother. So that, I think that's the key thing for this. You know, you go from think of all sensitive beings as having been your mother, then remember their kindness, wishing to repay your kindness, their kindness. But at the same time, you have this loved one. And in most of the stages, the love comes before the compassion. So my teacher is saying that love, think of it as affectionate love, you know. There's the compassion wishing to remove their suffering and the love which wishes for their happiness. But the love that comes immediately after repaying their kindness, or, you know, or even along with the repaying their kindness, is this idea of they should appear affectionate, that they're pleasant to you when they just come upon your side. So you trained your mind so well that just as when your mother appears, she appears just in that pleasing light, you're glad to see her. Just through the memories really you have of how nice she's been to you. So all beings should appear like that. Just kind of, yeah, they're just having that pleasing light. So it's kind of an affectionate love, a pleasing love, so that they appear into you in that pleasing light as you walk down Oxford Street, the throngs of people. So they've all been my mother. Yes, that's how you've got to do it. Automatic, just instinctive, like just, they all appear so pleasant to you. Now, no matter how kind of nasty they actually are in reality, you know, well, that's just their minds are twisted up, like your mother can go crazy with dementia and so forth. Anyway, you should do a bit of meditation, right? 15 minutes. So we go through these stages. So our motivation is exactly that bodhicitta. So we've taken refuge, and we have an idea of what we're taking refuge in, the magnificent teachings seem so promising, maybe difficult to get into, need a lot of acquaintance, but some things are, you know, we can see the point. Developing compassion. And if it leads to Buddhahood, so much the better. So first of all, let's just think, you know, let's just think what it feels like for somebody to have compassion to us. Because then we can sympathize, you know, with all those people who've lacked that kindness and motherly tenderness, you know, especially in their childhood when they're very vulnerable or very, you know, they lack independence. They need the mother's love, unconditional love, to sort of shelter them, to keep coming back to. So there are many people in the world who haven't had that, and you know, whatever they make of their lives, it sometimes can be very tragic. So let us just feel somebody being compassionate to us, just to start off with, just to feel what that's like. It can be, you know, our own mother, or it can be just a moment of compassion from somebody else, a grandparent, or just a friend, you know. It doesn't have to be like a lifelong type of love. Just, or even we can, you know, a Tibetan would all automatically choose Chenrezig, maybe. You know, the Dalai Lama, one with the Chenrezig. Think of the compassion emanating from such a being, you know, enveloping us. So just experience that kind of love coming our way, you know, so that we can be compassionate to ourselves, you know, not impatient, or we can just not be self-critical, but just rest in the kind regard of another. So then we know how good it feels to be cared for. Somebody cares for us without too much judgment. And especially when we're young, when we are a bit more innocent and vulnerable, how important that was. So we now have to try to generate that mind for that wide circle, that wide range of beings, whoever they are. So we have to try and approach that. Thought number one, equanimity. So we've all been wandering in cyclic existence, thrown here and there by influences that's far greater than we could cope with. We've been through all the different realms. We've been each kind of being that there is. So we've had all those experiences. So let's say, you know, the present harm or the present charm that people have just in this life compared to that sort of, you know, long vista of experiences, meetings, partings, births and deaths. The present, super attractions or, the present kind of, you know, petty sort of irritation and kind of, you know, anger with certain individuals is really, in that long perspective, it should be somewhat reduced. Again and again, we've stolen the egg from the hen. So now somebody comes and steals our property. What a surprise. Yeah, so we've spoken harsh words in the past. So if somebody speaks harsh, rough words to us, you know, it's only that wheel of sharp weapons turning and returning to cut us. We've been the fishing. We've been the fisherman who hooks the fish out of the ocean. So now the predator is coming and wants to, end our lives. So all things even out. So equanimity is the kind of the very sensible kind of philosophy. So then on that basis, you know, of equanimity towards all, then we have to add in the thought, yes, so given our so many lives, given our so many rebirths, given that so many rebirths are from the egg or from the womb, then it's quite difficult to say that any one of those creatures we meet, they've never been our mother. Very difficult to claim that. There's quite a good chance they have been. And once they became our mother, then, you know, that means they nurtured us in our body for however long it took. So they actually, you know, created our body from their own body. And then when we were so vulnerable, young and weak, they protected us. And then in certain rebirths, you know, it's a lot more than that. Then they have to rear us, you know, and educate us. And really kind of puzzle their brains to give us what we need in the way of training and discipline and kind of food and encouragement and inspiration, comfort. So we're not the only creatures who don't live by instinct alone. So many other animals, the children have to learn so much from the parents. And then also, you know, how many negative actions has our mother done for us? Just keeping our environment clean, you know, keeping us clean. How many bugs has she got to sort of clean away? And to feed us, you know, how much trouble she's gone to, which may have involved some kind of a negative action, you know, buying the food we like, giving us more attention. We are more important than the animal whose life goes into, you know, that piece of meat that she buys for our tea. That's kind of, you know, she's so worried about us that she's prepared even to do negative things on our behalf, you know, just out of kindness. Just out of, you know, that's another factor. So the idea behind this, you know, so when we walk down Oxford Street and all beings appear to us as, you know, sometime or another, they did us that great kindness of being a mother. We walk through the forest, so all the creatures there, animals, insects, birds. At one time they all, you know, did some huge amount of kindness to us. So the point is that then we really feel that those creatures are very, very lovely somehow. Not the superficial attraction of how they look, but, you know, in their being, their kind of quality of something is pleasing to us. That's how they should appear. Having an aspect of, you know, deserving our affection. They appear to us as very pleasant. So that's the point of the meditation, I think, you know. So no trouble is too much for us then. We cannot begrudge it. That's the idea. We think of all sentient beings as having been our mothers, or our fathers, or our brothers, or our sisters, or our sons, or our daughters. So says the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. So naturally we want to make an effort for them. Naturally we want to be there for them. Naturally we have to consider and wonder how we can help them. And wouldn't it be marvelous if we could have that power to, you know, see the way to erase the suffering of a being completely. We've had that experience in our own life, as you know, on our progress to Buddhahood. So then we really understand, you know, where suffering comes from at a deep level, so we can respond in a really skillful way in towards their suffering, helping them out of it. So then we need the full powers of Buddhahood. We need to meditate on the mother in exactly the way the Buddha taught. And then the limitations of our minds sort of, you know, drop away. And we enter into our Buddha nature. So then our powers are truly, you know, fantastic. So first of all then, the urge to become, you know, the urge to separate beings from their suffering, whoever they are, and in order to fulfill that, a striving for our own perfect, complete enlightenment. So that's bodhicitta, so that's the mind we're trying to generate, the spontaneous wish, ever arising, to do just that. So we'll have to stop there now. Dedicate your merits to the near and dear ones, or those who are sick, or those who are in need, to your gurus, and to quickly becoming enlightened for the sake of all. Dedication prayers on page 24. Well, one of them is, anyway. And then, if you can find that sheet of the new sheet of the one with the clear realizations verses, there's the bodhicitta dedication verse on there. We could do that in English if you have that handy. The bottom of the verses we chanted this morning. So first the one at top of page 24. Gewa di nyo du da glama sangye drup gyo ne dro wa chi gyang ma lo pa kyo ki sa la ge pa shos. Bodhicitta in English. Bodhicitta, precious mind, where not born may it be born, where born may it not decline, only increase more and more. His Holiness Dalai Lama, back on page 24. Kangri rawe kowe jinkamde, pendende wa malu jungwene, chen reizi wan ten zing yatso yi, Shabesite badu ten gyochi. So I don't know where the one for Lama's Opus gone, but... Tubsu jang shing jam gung gelwe. No, I'm not sure about this one. Tub su chang xin gyam gung gyawa. Beg. Da pa dze. Chok sum wele mung drupa. Pa dak so du jay gun du shap ten shok.